The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey and Jersey in toto. Another program for Inside Medicine is slated. We have an excellent guest, Dr. Jack Kanoff. Dr. Kanoff is a seasoned pulmonologist who goes to a number of hospitals in South Jersey, sees a ton of patients, has tons of experience, and we are going to educate you on pulmonary. That's going to include sleep apnea, pulmonary cancer, asthma, et cetera, et cetera. Jack will be here in a minute. I just have a short intro this week. At trees.com, a survey reported nearly half of the people say they talk to their plants, with 62% saying it helps their mental health. 48% admit talking to their trees or plants. 65% say it helps their plants grow. As many say, what's this world coming to? Let's check out the plant site. Another indication of where this world is going, the University of Penn demonstrated microbots, got to look up that definition, via hand-free toothbrushing and also rinsing, brushing teeth, and can floss your teeth also, these little bots that they put in your mouth. Obviously, there is work to be done on these bots, and we might need to put a few fences around some of the University of Penn research buildings, as now you have one that can do your total mouth care with bots. Please look up the definition of bots. When you hear it's different this time, what do you think? How do you respond? Given that there is approximately 8 billion humans in the world, let's think a little harder when we hear it's different this time. Now, let me introduce Dr. Jack Kanoff. Dr. Kanoff is a superb pulmonologist in the South Jersey marketplace. Covers a lot of hospitals, sees tons of patients, tons of experience, and I want to say I'm very pleased to get Jack on Inside Medicine. Jack.
Hi, Joe. Nice to talk to you again.
Fantastic. That's right. People have to remember that Jack was on a show previously, and you can look at our website, www.wwdbam.com. Just click Inside Medicine, then go to Podcast. You can scroll through. There's 120 allowed on the website, and Jack is on there. And this is a number two. So let me ask you this, Jack. I just want to ask a real short question. Is Proventil a risky drug?
So Proventil is a brand name of albuterol. Albuterol is a short-acting beta agonist. It's a medication that's used to dilate the airways. It's used for emergencies, or what we call as a rescue inhaler. So if somebody has an episode where they become short of breath and they don't respond to just sitting and resting, or to use it prior to doing something like exercise, it'll help open up the airways so they can breathe better. If it's used the way it's supposed to be used, it's not that dangerous. The problem becomes with this, as lots of other medicines, if it's not used in the correct fashion, it can cause problems. So we do know that Proventil or albuterol has the capability of causing increased heart rate or tachycardia. So it can have cardiac effects. It can also affect things like your potassium. So if it's used too much, too frequently, yes, it can be harmful. If it's used the way it's supposed to be used, it's an effective agent in helping patients with underlying lung disease.
I just had to ask you that, Jack, because years ago when I worked at a pharmacy, we opened up one morning in Baltimore, and there was three people standing there huffing and puffing, short of breath, and we need my inhaler, I need my inhaler, I need my inhaler. It was like a dramatic. I think they chose to sit outside the pharmacy instead of going to the ER, and it was dramatic in my mind how they were so dependent on a drug that dilated their lungs. Of course, it has risk, and that's why I was hoping you'd comment. Now, can I just move on to the topic of pulmonary hypertension? A lot of things are new in that. Can you just help us out? What the heck is pulmonary hypertension?
Sure. So it's interesting. Most people are familiar with high blood pressure or hypertension. When you go to your doctor or you go to the pharmacy and you get your blood pressure checked and you get a top number and a bottom number. The blood vessels in the lung are a different type of system. So you have a top number called a systolic pressure and a bottom number called a diastolic pressure. But the idea in the lung is it's a very low pressure system. So if a normal blood pressure for somebody is 120 over 80, for example, a normal pressure in the lung might be something like 25 over 10. It's designed as a low pressure system so that when the heart pumps, the blood can go from the heart to the lungs to get oxygen without making the heart pump and work too hard. So ideally, it's a beautiful system. The problem occurs when something causes the pressures in the lung to elevate, and when those pressures go up, it makes the heart work a lot harder, and especially the right side of the heart. So the blood comes back from the body to the right side of the heart to get pumped to the lungs. The left side of the heart, which pumps the blood to the body, is a thick muscle. And the right side is not that kind of a muscle. It's a much thinner muscle, and it doesn't have the strength that the left side has. And therefore, it can become easily overwhelmed if the pressures get too high. And if those pressures do go high, it has a lot of potential complications and symptoms that can be associated with it that a lot of people would recognize.
So in other words, what you're saying is the right side of the heart doesn't have to push against a high gradient. You want that blood coming back from the toes and the brain to go quickly to the lungs so the oxygen can get replaced on those molecules, hemoglobin molecules. When it goes to the left side, it's got has to pump it around to your little toes and everywhere else, so it's got a much higher, stronger muscle. And usually the one that goes bad is the left. But what you're saying in this case, it's the right side that's really taking a beating.
Correct. And then if we have those high pressures and the right side has a problem, it's pretty common to see symptoms that a lot of people would recognize. The classic symptom is you'll get people who will complain of feeling more and more short of breath with less and less exertion. So before they could walk all the way around the block, now they can walk a half a block or a quarter of a block. That's one common thing that lots of people can identify with. Another common side effect that people will recognize is they'll start to get swelling in the legs or edema. And they'll see increased swelling in the legs in the morning when you wake up, when you've had your legs elevated, that swelling will go down. And as the day goes on and the heart's working harder, and it's working harder against higher pressures in the lung, all of a sudden you start to get more swelling. And whether the swelling is in the leg or in the arms or in the stomach or wherever, you'll see that. So those are pretty common symptoms that lots of people have had to deal with in their life.
So pulmonary hypertension sounds like it's a pretty serious issue, and I do know that some of the research is pushing towards giving medications that you can inhale to help that situation. How do you treat pulmonary hypertension?
Well, the interesting thing for us is that when we look at pulmonary hypertension, we group the causes of pulmonary hypertension into five distinct groups. One of the groups, for example, is patients who have heart disease. So either they've had heart attacks or they have problems with the valve of the heart. That's one group. And another group that's a common group is patients with lung disease. So patients with things like COPD or patients with scar tissue diseases of the lung like asbestosis, or even patients with things like sleep apnea, like we talked about before, they can all have elevated pressures in the lung. And the problem is that the medicines that we have available to treat, we can only use to treat two of the five groups and maybe part of one of the other groups. So the medicines are not beneficial for everybody, which is a shame because the largest group of people who have this are people who have underlying heart or lung disease. And we all know how common heart and lung disease is in our society. So
go ahead. Sorry. Keep going because this is something I don't know a lot about.
So generally we have pill form of medications that we can use to help dilate the blood vessels in the lung. So it helps open the blood vessels in the lung to allow that blood flow to get into the lung to get oxygen easier than when the vessels were constricted. They're dilating the blood vessels as opposed to, we had talked before about the Proventil, the albuterol, that dilates the airways, not the blood vessels. So there's different groups. The one that people are familiar with is the group of medicines for which things like Viagra or Cialis are part of. Those medicines can also dilate the airway, the blood vessels inside the lung. That's one group. There's two or three other types. Also, like you had talked about, we do have medicines that are more powerful that we can give now either by inhalation or we can use analogs of those medicines by pill. And the advance is that this used to be something where people would have to walk around with an intravenous attached all the time. So it's a significant advance from where we were at 10, 15 years ago.
So is that medicine expensive?
It's hard to imagine medicines anymore that aren't expensive, but unfortunately, these medicines are very expensive. The medicines that are the least expensive for treating pulmonary hypertension are the ones that are in the same category as Viagra. You're taking significantly larger doses than you would take if you were using it for other reasons, but that's a generic medicine, so that one is not too bad. But a lot of these others could be thousands of dollars a month.
So again, you have this setup where you have the right side of the heart pumping blood to the lungs. The lungs are supposed to hook new oxygen onto the red cells. Then it's supposed to go back to the heart and it's supposed to pump it out to your toes and your brain, et cetera. So tell me about the heart. If you have pulmonary hypertension, does it make the heart go bad, maybe the left chamber?
And the answer to that is absolutely. We understand that there are long-term complications with pulmonary hypertension. It very clearly can affect the heart and cause heart failure. It can affect the lung with increasing difficulty with breathing. And we know that untreated pulmonary hypertension does have a prognosis which isn't really that good. So the long-term prognosis for patients, especially in some of the groups, might be only 3 or 4 years once the diagnosis is made. It makes it that much more important to recognize it. So patients need to understand that if they start seeing symptoms like shortness of breath with exertion or swelling, they do need to see their docs they need to get checked out, because the sooner you get treated, the sooner you get this under better control. Not only will they live longer, but their quality of life will be significantly improved.
And anything hot coming down the pike, such as an inhalation agent that could make it easier and less expensive, or not?
I know that there's ongoing trials for multiple different things. They're looking at other types of medications also. To me, one of the important things is trying to figure out if there are opportunities to treat larger groups of patients that we thought in the past would not benefit. So like we said, patients with, for example, patients who have scar tissue type diseases of the lung, those are patients that it's a pretty big group of patients. And for those people, if we can find a way to treat them, we're helping a lot of people. If we find, for example, patients with valvular disease of the heart, you're talking about millions of patients that might benefit from it. So if we're able to expand the use of treatment to groups that right now we aren't able to, then we've done something to help a lot of people, and that's what we're here for.
Gotcha. Let me ask you this. When do you have to push the button and say it's time to go to a place like Temple for a lung bypass? How often does that come up?
So for me, once I'm getting into a higher level where I'm looking at either intravenous or subcutaneous medicine, I'll usually in the community, and a lot of pulmonologists in the community will be comfortable treating patients with multiple medications. The recommendation is to use multiple medications, including a combination therapy that's been shown to be more effective than single therapy alone. So if we can start them on multiple medications, we're good. But if we see that they're continuing to progress or they're not responding like we would like, that's the time to start looking at sending them to a center. The good thing for us is that we have some very powerful centers of research and treatment for pulmonary hypertension just in our area. So we'll use Temple Lung Center and University of Pennsylvania very frequently for much more complicated cases.
Got it. So can I just switch a little bit here? When it comes down to sleep apnea, which is a whole different kettle of fish, what is the AHI measurement? Because I find people don't understand that too much. And what does that mean to the pulmonologist taking care of somebody with sleep apnea?
Gotcha. So when we're dealing with sleep apnea, we're looking to see how often somebody will stop breathing when they're sleeping. And there's two different things that we're specifically looking for. The A is apnea. So an apnea is a 10-second period of time where 90% of that 10 seconds there's no breathing at all. That's called an apnea. It has to be a minimum of 10 seconds, and it can be much longer than that. I mean, we'll have patients who will have these periods for 60, 80 seconds per episode. The other is, the H part is hypopnea. So in a hypopnea, think about a hypopnea as shallow breathing. So every time you breathe, you're breathing a certain amount of air. So each breath has a certain amount of air. And with a hypopnea, what we see is the amount of air that somebody breathes has to decrease by 30 to 40%, so shallow breathing. But because it's not stopping breathing, it's just shallow breathing, the rules state that that has to be associated with something else. For example, when you go to the doctors, when you go to the emergency room, they put a thing on your finger to measure the percent of oxygen in your blood. And during your sleep study, they're measuring that also. And these episodes where you have shallow breathing or hypopneas, they're frequently associated with a decrease in the percent of oxygen in your blood of at least 3 or 4%. Also, when we're looking at the brain waves while we're doing one of these studies, we'll see what's called an arousal. An arousal is not necessarily where somebody wakes up, but it's an episode where the brain wave will change. And it could just be they moved in sleep, for example, and you see an abnormality in the brainwave pattern that interrupts the stage of sleep that the patient had been in. So the apnea, 10 seconds where they stop breathing, plus the hypopnea, 10 seconds where the breathing becomes shallow and it's associated with something. We take the total number of those episodes throughout the night. And ideally, you want to divide that into how much time they sleep. And that gives you the number of episodes each hour that they stop breathing. What makes an abnormal number? If you stop less than 5 times an hour, that's normal. 5 to 14 episodes is mild. 15 to 29 episodes is moderate. 30 or more episodes is severe. And I have lots of patients who stop well over 100 times an hour.
That does not sound too good, because I think that means you're not getting oxygen. That means your toes are going to be a little mad. That means that your brain's going to even be madder.
And your heart and everything else. The way I like to explain it to patients is this. If you stop breathing 120 times an hour, that's twice every minute. And if the average amount of time that you stop breathing is 20 seconds, if you have 2 20-second episodes, that means 40 out of every 60 seconds, you're not breathing. So I'll say to patients, imagine it this way. You're sleeping 6 hours. 4 of those 6 hours you don't breathe for. So I'll sit here with my watch and I'll say, okay, hold your breath for the next 4 hours. Let's see how you do.
I think that makes the point very strongly, but the problem is what is the effect on patients who have sleep apnea, say who are over 20% or 20 AHI at 20, what happens to those people? What happens to their life?
So, the first thing to start with is, well, what do they come in complaining of? So the classic things that we talk about are things like snoring. Your partner or somebody in the family will see you stopping breathing when you sleep. Morning headaches is very common. Restless sleep, where you'll toss and turn and it looks like a train went through your bed at night. Tired in the morning, tired during the day. Lack of energy. Reduction in your ability to think, your focus, your memory, and your concentration. Those are the kind of symptoms that patients will come in with, or more commonly, that the spouse will make the patient come in with. What they don't see is the long-term effects. And what we understand is that untreated sleep apnea is associated with lots of things that we really don't want. Whether it's stroke, whether it's heart attacks, whether it's rhythm disturbances of the heart like atrial fibrillation, even simple things like you wouldn't think of like depression and anxiety are all associated with it. Another common thing, especially in your area, is we know that untreated sleep apnea and poor sleep is strongly correlated with weight gain, and that treating that will help with helping to control the weight gain. So lots of long-term effects. Besides that, just some of the other things that we mentioned, you'll find patients who get treated, they're able to think, focus, they can concentrate better. Their minds don't wander. The typical sleep apnea patient, we go through a series of questions called the Epworth score, which asks us, all right, if I put you in a situation how likely would you be to doze off? For example, if you're the passenger of in a car, not the driver, but the passenger, and you're driving for more than an hour at the time, what's the likelihood that you would doze off? There's a series of those types of questions, and we know that if the total sum is greater than 10, there's a very high likelihood that you do have sleep apnea.
So I've seen patients just simply drive off the road or stop at a light and find themselves that they pushed on the gas, didn't even know it, and ended up on the side of the road. And, just red light, get this person to a pulmonologist quick. But the other issue is I have to kind of like sometimes, you know, the problem is nobody wants to admit that they have a sleep apnea problem. So sometimes when someone comes in, usually it's someone referred in for impotency, because basically God doesn't want people producing kids if they've got sleep apnea. So what he does or she does is she drops your testosterone really low. So the patient comes in for impotency, and what happens is I ask them, you know, do you snore? And they say, no. And I say, do you have a cell phone? And then I ask, would you please call your wife? And they call the wife up, and I, can I speak to your wife? And the guy says, sure. And I said, what about your husband? Does he stop breathing? He said, what are you talking about? He snores so bad, I'm sleeping in the other room, so I can't tell if he stops breathing anymore. So it's just that a lot of people, when they have this sleep apnea, in my opinion, just don't have good insight into what's happening to them. A lot of people just say they don't have any problems when they see you?
Well, the good thing is, like I said, it's always helpful in these situations, like you were saying, if the spouse is, or the significant other is there for the appointment, or that you can get a hold of somebody. But I think it's very common that patients are in denial. They don't remember. This is an event that occurs when you're asleep. It's not when you're awake. It's not like you're snoring when you're awake. This occurs when you're asleep. So they don't know that they're doing it. And it's very common for people to deny it, thinking, oh, it doesn't happen to me, it happens to somebody else. So having insight from somebody else, whether it's a spouse, I mean, the classic stories are things like, I have lots of patients who'll go camping or guys will go hunting, and they don't want somebody to come because their snoring scares away the deer. So we get that all the time. So getting that insight from somebody is sort of what forces them to come in. You're 100% correct that most people aren't willing to admit that it might be them that has this problem. The other thing that I just want to point out is people imagine that somebody with sleep apnea is 400 pounds and massively overweight. And what I tell you is that I have patients with sleep apnea who are thin, and I have lots of patients with sleep apnea who are normal weight. So you don't have to be, a big offensive lineman or something like that to have sleep apnea. The quarterback or the running back can get it too.
So let me ask you a question. So the issue here is that when I see someone come in the office and they have tons of blood, and I tell them they have ketchup blood, and they look at me like saying, what are you talking about? Well, if you have a high hematocrit at 52, where the average person is probably at 45, that usually means that somebody's body is just racking up some extra blood, so then when they stop breathing at night, they can take some extra oxygen off the excess blood that they're now carrying. And I do know that for efficiency, the hematologists tell me that if you have a crit of 52, 50% of them recommend you should take a unit of blood off because you're overcompensating to your detriment. And if you have a hematocrit of 54, it's almost 98%. So when I tell people they have ketchup blood, sometimes I can get them to at least go to the pulmonologist because I get a lot of resistance with somebody who just doesn't want to admit that they have a problem because maybe they just can't even recognize it. So do you see a lot of ketchup blood in the patients that you evaluate initially for sleep apnea?
So for me, in my practice, where I see that more likely than sleep apnea, for me, is patients with advanced emphysema. So patients with either advanced emphysema or patients with advanced, for example, interstitial lung disease, where they have so much scar tissue with the lungs that they can't get oxygen in, so the body makes extra blood cells to try to get whatever oxygen it can. But in patients with very advanced sleep apnea, those are classically the very morbidly obese types who are really bad. Those patients, we will see them with very high hematocrits. Generally speaking, we end up having to take a unit of blood. For sure, if they're 54 or 55, sometimes if they're 52, but for sure when they're getting 54 or 55, you need to do it because there's too much risk for bad things happening with that much blood, like stroke.
Gotcha. Does sleep apnea have any cardiac manifestations?
Oh, absolutely. So the heart doctors will almost universally send their patients with atrial fibrillation for a sleep study. And we know that there's a very strong correlation with sleep apnea and atrial fibrillation. Probably 75 to 85% of patients with atrial fibrillation have sleep apnea. So it's a very, very strong correlation. The interesting thing is that the most common rhythm disturbance of the heart in patients with sleep apnea is not atrial fibrillation, but sinus bradycardia, which means that the heart slows down instead of going fast and irregular. One of the reasons that we like to do a sleep test on a cardiac patient, a patient with heart disease, we like to do those in the sleep lab as opposed to a home study, is this. The home study is a nice screening test for sleep apnea, and it will monitor between 4 and 7 different channels. As opposed to the study in the lab, monitors 16 different channels, including things like your brain waves, which allows me to see exactly how much sleep and what type of sleep you're getting. But more importantly, in these types of patients, the home study does not monitor the EKG. So without monitoring the EKG, there's no way for me to know what happens to the heart when the patient stops breathing. Patient stops breathing, we talked about his oxygen level dropping, and it's really nice to know what happens to the heart when that occurs. With a home study, I can't really see that. I can only see that with an in-lab study that also monitors the EKG.
Well, Jack, I would say that my opinion is that so many people I know have sleep apnea just clinically. They get that home study and it says they're normal. It drives me crazy because my opinion is the when you study in a sleep lab, the efficacy is so much better, the results are so much clearer, and I don't get false negatives. So
the problem that we have is insurance. So a lot of the insurance companies won't cover the in-lab study. You fight for it, and they still refuse it. So you're sort of stuck. The other issue is that, for me, the home study tends more to underestimate the degree of sleep apnea than overestimate it. So one of the things that we had talked about, tell me if it's okay if I go through this. One of the things that we talked about was we look at the number of episodes that they stop breathing and the number of episodes that they shallow breathe, and we divide that into the amount of sleep. Well, in the home study, you don't know exactly how much time that person slept. So what you're really doing is you're dividing the number of episodes that they stop breathing or they shallow breathe, and you divide that into the amount of time that they were monitored. So if you think about it, if I monitor somebody and they're wearing their monitor at home for 10 hours and they stop breathing 100 times, that's 10 times an hour. But if it turns out they really only slept 5 of those 10 hours, so that 10 times an hour now becomes 20 times an hour. So it tends to underestimate where they're really at. Now, it's little bit harder, like you were saying, because without looking at the brain waves and knowing what's really happening, you can't look at arousals. You can only look at what happens with the oxygen saturation. So it makes it more difficult to interpret episodes of shallow breathing and count those as part of the number of episodes during the night. So ideally, if we could do them all in lab, we're better off. The reality of it is, I can't imagine the insurance companies turning around and agreeing to pay for them all. And then what do we do?
Well, I will say one thing. The one thing you did point out was, do they monitor for atrial fibrillation on the home studies?
They do not. That's the problem. So what
the
I do is I was going to say what...
Jack, I mean, you're basically setting those guys up for stroke and MI. It blows my mind.
I agree.
Nobody gets it. But if you throw that little clot, you lost part of your brain, and you can't even diagnose it. Then you have to fight them to try and get the real sleep study.
So what I do in those situations is I'll write on the prescription that has to be done in lab because of underlying heart disease. That's been shown, and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has that listed as one of the reasons that require an in-lab study instead of a home study. And then we end up having to call and fight with the insurance companies to get it. But those situations like atrial fibrillation, it's worth fighting for because, like you said, you might be missing something that could be catastrophic for a patient.
Yeah, well, a stroke is definitely catastrophic. So I'm with you 100%. Let me just try and move ahead to one other item that hasn't covered. I basically ask a lot of people, because a lot of people come in and the spouse will say, my husband's just not as sharp as he was before, or vice versa. And I try and get people to try and figure out how many REM cycles they get, because I find that people with sleep apnea just get a little stupider all the time because they basically have these hypoxic episodes. And the question is, if they don't get their REM sleep, if you don't get your 2.5 cycles, how many people are, quote, a little bit more stunod than they should have never been? Do you ever look for REM frequency, because it usually should be 2.5 cycles a night?
I always look for REM. When we look at stages of sleep, the way that I look at it is stage one sleep, which is really light, should be about 2-5% of your sleep that night. Stage two is the biggest stage. It should be about 45-55%. Stage three, which is the deepest sleep where the brain waves are the slowest, that's 20-25%, and REM sleep should be about the same, at 20-25%. Now, those stages of sleep will vary from young to old, so you do adjust it based on the age. So as we mature in life, we get less REM sleep, and we also lose stage three sleep. So you'll see a lot of older patients complaining that they just don't feel rested when they're waking up. Even though they may not have sleep apnea, it's because of the changes in the sleep cycles that they have. So I always look for REM sleep. And then one of the other things that we'll always do is you're going to look at the medications that they're taking, because a lot of medications can have effect on REM sleep. So for example, A lot of patients are on beta blockers. Beta blockers are used a lot for heart disease, and they're used a lot for a high blood pressure. So it's a very common medication, like Lopressor, Metoprolol, or Carvedilol. And we know beta blockers can affect REM sleep. So you may be using something to help control their blood pressure or their heart, but at the same point, you're causing them to have other complications, such as loss of REM sleep.
And REM is important. Can I just switch up a little bit here?
Anything you would like.
Okay. In your business, steroids are kind of like something that's kind of necessary to use. And I'm just curious, how do you deal with people on steroids, especially as, you know, they kind of like keep upping the dose and ask for more refills than the directions would indicate? How do you see steroids and steroid abuse in your patients?
So it's a real issue. And one of the things that I just want to make sure there's no confusion about is when you're talking to me about steroids, you're talking to me about steroids by pill. One of the benefits for me is that when I use an inhaled steroid, I'm using about 1/1000th the dose of what a pill would be. So an inhaled steroid is nice because it goes directly into the lung. You don't have to swallow the pill. It doesn't have to get absorbed in the stomach. It doesn't have to go through the body, and therefore you use a much higher dosage. So we can treat a lot with an inhaled steroid and not have to use the steroid by pill, which are much more likely to cause a problem. For me, I almost never have anybody on chronic steroids for the majority of the time. There are some cases, for example, patients with things like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis that may be involving the lung, that I may have no choice but to have them on some steroid plus something else. Another disease that we use steroids for a lot is something called sarcoidosis. But I think what we've come to now is, number one, you want to use the lowest dose possible and not allow it to escalate and increase over time. And the second is that most of these diseases, we're looking for a steroid-sparing agent. So you're going to look for something that you can use in addition to the steroid to be able to allow you to reduce the steroid dose and still get the effect.
Gotcha. So again, you know, the steroids tend to melt your bones, which is not a good thing, especially long-term. And those hip fractures definitely are challenging. So again, I understand that the steroids are necessary. They make patients feel so much better. But it's kind of hard when you're short of breath to say, I'm not going to take my steroid. But like you say, in the pulmonary business, you guys can at least try and get the steroid through the aerosol so that they doesn't get a chance to hit their bones.
Correct. And it doesn't affect their sugars. And, you know, obviously, that's something really important for you.
Yes. So the less steroid, but the answer is that steroids are such a wonderful drug that I can understand where the patient's coming from, but I just have to kind of fight them to keep the dose low. But I guess basically you have a ton of patients because you get those patients in the ICU or intubated and it's kind of necessary. That's the only time you guys really have to push the steroids aggressively.
I apologize. I missed part of what you said.
I just said one of the reasons that you guys use a lot of steroids IV is when somebody is trying to avoid intubation or has significant inflammation lungs and are in an ICU case.
Yeah, and that's a different situation. I mean, you're talking about an acute critical problem. That's, you know, if somebody is bad enough that they're in the hospital because they can't breathe, you're going to do whatever you can to try to help them. But that's a short-term thing. You know, you're not looking at keeping them on steroids long-term. But if you need to use steroids so the patient can breathe, so they don't end up on life support, that's well worth it.
You go for it. So let me ask you this. One of the things that I always hated about when I did a pulmonary rotation years and years ago was so many cancer patients. How good are things right now with diagnosis of lung cancer, and how's that going from the pulmonary perspective?
So there's been significant advances in diagnosing lung cancer. So we now have a whole variety of newer techniques to be able to get to a cancer without having to go in and do surgery and open up the chest or open up the lung. The other thing is, not only can we avoid the surgery, but we're able to get, with some of these newer techniques, something called navigational bronchoscopy or endobronchial ultrasound guided biopsy. We can now biopsy lesions that are much smaller than what we used to be able to reach. So, for example, we can have a good chance of getting something that's 10 millimeters. Now, 10 millimeters, to give you a perspective, an inch is 25 millimeters. So you're talking about less than a half an inch. Whereas in the past, we would be lucky to get something that was 20 millimeters. So the ability to get much smaller lesions means you're likely getting something at an earlier stage. If I find a cancer that's a stage one cancer, I've got a 65, 70, maybe 75% chance for cure. On the other hand, if I find a cancer that's a stage three or stage four, I might have a 25, 35% chance for cure. And that's a big difference.
Sure is, especially when you're talking about a cure. So these techniques, are they done generally as an outpatient or inpatient?
They can be done either way. Most of them are done as an outpatient. Same like you would have a colonoscopy. You come in, you have it. We give you medicine so you don't remember a blessed thing about it. And you go home happy after a great sleep, and you don't remember anything.
So what about, from your perspective, how have things moved up from an oncology perspective for lung cancer? And what do they have, about five different types these days?
So what's really nice is this immunotherapy that we have now. So it used to be you used radiation therapy or you used hardcore chemotherapy. This targeted specific immunotherapy, which specifically targets that particular cancer and the genetic mutation that cancer has, the response that we see sometimes with this is just amazing. I mean, we'll have patients who have just a tremendous amount of cancer in their body, and when they respond to this immunotherapy, you watch it melt away. It's amazing. And that's not something we ever used to see years ago.
So what's the definition of immunotherapy?
So that's the kinds of things that you would see. So you've seen advertisements. Most patients have seen advertisements for things like Keytruda or Opdivo. These are medications that are targeted to a specific gene mutation in that cancer to attack that area and that area specifically. So it works for one particular type, but it doesn't work for something else. So if you gave the wrong immunotherapy, it would actually make them worse, not better. So you really have to make sure that you're matching the genetic mutations of that patient's cancer to the specific agent that you choose to use. And frequently what we're seeing is they'll use regular chemotherapy with the immunotherapy initially, maybe four cycles of that, and then just use the immunotherapy afterwards. And the response that we get and the amount of time that patients now have that they didn't have before to enjoy life and have a reasonable quality of life has been so much improved compared to where we were at before.
So I have to say this, that before the first immunotherapy was approved, I had a consultation in the hospital for somebody, a young girl in her 30s who had this big gumbo on the top of her head. And I walked in to see her at night, and I got a consult for hyperthyroidism. And usually I would say, I basically say, you're hyperthyroid. We checked her thyroid gland. We started medication for the hyperthyroidism. And lo and behold, I went home and looked up the drug. It was actually Keytruda before it was approved. And it said that those medications can induce someone to become hyperthyroid. Mm-hmm. So basically, I changed my therapy. The patient's thyroid got better. The mass on the top of her head melted away. Other masses on her body melted away. And like you said, I was so shocked to see how well this young lady did. And she got a cure from Keytruda. Just absolutely stunning. But again, you need to know what you're doing, because that drug can induce other
problems
that go.
Yeah, one of the problems that we'll see sometimes is it can cause an acute inflammatory response to the lung called a chemical pneumonitis. And if it does that to the lung, those can be very difficult to treat.
Magic cures, magic drugs, and I have to say this, that I think Keytruda goes off the market as a Merck product, I think in less than a year. So luckily that medication will even become possible for many more people. But phenomenal drugs, and like you say, you see it more than me, but I am always impressed by what happens. So I have to just ask you, what about cigarette smoking? I hear you guys okay that.
So what I, you know, it's interesting, because what I see a lot when I talk to patients now, you know, and I harp on this all the time with my patients, but we're seeing more and more vaping than we used to, and we're seeing vaping in older patients, not just teenage kids. And people don't understand what I'll get from them is, well, I'm vaping, but I'm not using any nicotine. Well, maybe, but you're still breathing in a ton of other bad things into your lungs that can cause all sorts of issues, including complete respiratory failure with something called acute respiratory distress syndrome. So that's something that I fight on all the time. They did have... Last year, they came out with new guidelines for recommendations for smoking cessation. And my interpretation of it is, use whatever you can, whatever will work. So, for example, we used to use something called Chantix, varenicline,
yes,
which does have some potential side effects where it can cause stomach issues, and it can cause severe nightmares, especially in patients who've previously, for example, been in the military, and they'll recall some bad things that they went through. We used to not use any kind of nicotine replacement with it, because these are nicotine receptor antagonists, so it would go to the sites in the brain where nicotine would normally go. The nicotine would knock it off, and you just have circulating medicine not doing very much. Well, the new recommendations say do whatever you need to do, so you can combine the Chantix with whatever will work for that patient. One of the things that I always recommend is it's not just replacing the nicotine. It's the habit of having something in your hand, and you're putting it into your mouth. So people will talk about chew gum or use lollipops, or I've had patients who carry around like coffee stirrers and they keep them in their mouth. But I've had a few patients who did something pretty interesting. So what they did is they bought a whole bunch of cinnamon sticks that are hollow in the middle, and they can put it in their mouth and pretend it's like a cigarette. It tastes good, and there's no calories.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So, Jack, we're getting a little bit close to the end, and I just wanted to say, obviously, you're a fantastic pulmonologist, good bedside manner, excellent diagnostician, hardworking. How can somebody get in touch with you if they'd like to make a visit? I'm sure you don't need anybody, but would you like to give out your office number and maybe talk about your two partners?
Sure. My office number is 609-561-7666. There's three of us in the practice. We're all well experienced. We've all been in practice for 30 years. My partners, one is from South Jersey. They both trained here in South Jersey also. And it feels like we're everywhere, but we're all over the place. But our main office is in Hamilton. We have an office in Elmer, and we work through the Inspira Hospital System, and we're happy to help.
I know you are. So let me just ask one final question. Just got to say it. So would you do it again, become a pulmonologist?
Oh, I love what I do. The only thing that I would maybe do slightly different is if I listened to my wife and my kids, it wouldn't work so hard. But I love what I do. I mean, I'm very happy with my choice of profession.
Well, I think South Jersey and your patients are very lucky. That's all I can say. I think your wife's a champ. And I think that all I can say is I appreciate you hopping on. Dr. Canoff's podcast will be up in less than 2 hours, www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine and then go to the podcast. There's 120 up. You can also check for Jack's initial one. So, Jack, I want to thank you for hopping on Inside Medicine. Next week we'll be back. Make sure everybody checks out those podcasts. And Jack Canoff, I hope you keep on practicing forever. Carry on.
Thank you, Joe.
Carry on.